KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Bullying isn't new, but the internet and social media have morphed it into something much more sinister. Emily Bazelon talks about the devastating consequences of bullying, as well as what parents and educators can do to promote empathy and understanding. Bazelon is a senior editor at Slate and the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She spoke with The Stranger editorial director, Dan Savage, at Town Hall on April 29th, 2013.
Good evening.
Good evening.
It's nice to see you again.
It's great to be here.
I feel underdressed. You look very nice.
And I feel overdressed, like I think I'm in New York City or something.
I want to jump right into the book, and we only have 45 minutes to talk about it, and it is a big and, I think, really important book. And as somebody who's been writing about and interested in the subject of bullying and in the schools, and particularly as it impacts LGBT kids, disproportionately so impacts LGBT kids, this book really kind of, I think, is hugely important in the way it fleshes out and turns what had been becoming a very black and white, good kids, bad kids, black hats, white hats issue into a much more complicated, nuanced problem that there are approaches that can be solved. I was so thrilled with it and kind of staggered. I've read it twice.
And now thank you.
And now I will stop humping your leg.
No, you can keep it right on going.
So one of the distinctions you try to make in the book, and successfully so, for adults who may now be overreacting to any evidence of conflict in a school environment between kids, is a distinction that the children that you were profiling and meeting with and interviewing made, which was the difference between drama and bullying. What is the difference, and how do we as adults and educators tell the difference, and how should we react to drama versus bullying?
So, right, drama is a word that the teenagers taught me, and what they mean by that is a conflict that's going back and forth, where different people hold the power at different moments. And I think what's different about bullying is that you have a power differential that stays the same. And so essentially you're talking about a chronic campaign to make a kid miserable. And it's that repetition and that power imbalance that is what researchers have really identified as the aspect of kids harassing or abusing each other that is the most difficult for them to deal with over time. So I think when you have that limited definition of bullying, then you have your hands around the behaviors that really cause trouble for kids, as opposed to the stuff that we can give them more room to sort it out themselves, because they do need to have some room to learn how to deal with conflict.
And how to resolve conflict. And it does feel like we've defined bullying down to a point where any discouraging word, any little flare-up between two students is pathologized in this way. And just like kids being sent home for zero tolerance on drugs or zero tolerance on weapons in schools, sometimes very ham-fistedly winds up punishing kids who did nothing wrong, in a way, some of the reaction to the bullying epidemic, if we can call it that, maybe we shouldn't, you can talk about that, is making school harder? Is it making it harder for schools to address the bullying problem that does exist?
Well, I do think that's a big risk. And if I never heard the words zero tolerance again, I would be perfectly happy.
You have zero tolerance.
I have zero tolerance because, you know, when we end up with these kind of straitjacket approaches for schools, I think we make it really hard for people to take context into account and be more sensitive to a particular situation. And, you know, one of the reasons this is such a hard issue to deal with is what you started out by saying. We both still have a problem of under-policing bullying and adults turning a blind eye and over-policing it and being so concerned about it that we now are sweeping in ordinary aspects of teasing. And you can see this in the state laws. There's this kind of schizophrenia right now where some states are really pushing for punishment and they're defining bullying very broadly. And other states have a more limited definition and are going more in the direction of prevention and intervention. So it's like there's this clear choice and we haven't quite figured out as a country which direction we want to go in.
You give a very specific definition of bullying in the book, the standard definition, the accepted definition. What is that?
It's verbal or physical abuse that's repeated over time and involves a power imbalance. And it comes from Dan Olweus, who is the Scandinavian researcher who's the grandfather of this field. And essentially, in the late 60s, he realized that nobody had asked kids before what kind of peer behavior really bothered them. And so he had a study of about 400 kids in Sweden where he said, you know, what is it about these interactions that really gets to you? And it was the kids who helped him come up with this definition. And since then, over decades, psychologists have really confirmed a lot of his initial findings about how harmful it is.
The book opens with you talking about your experience having been fired as a friend. You were friends with some girls in eighth grade, and you woke up one day and you had been fired as a friend and sort of were excluded from this clique that you had been a part of. And that was really a painful experience for you, kind of a defining experience for you. But looking back on it, even though, you know, as I read that, I thought that was very bullying in the way girls bully, which isn't with fists, it's with exclusion and social marginalization, right? And I thought that was horrible, but at the end of it, you write that it shaped your character, it made you more empathetic, and looking back, you were a better person for having gone through this experience.
Right. So I think this is a good example of kind of a manageable amount of adversity in a kid's life. I was really miserable for some months of eighth grade. I went home, I cried a lot, I felt terrible. And it certainly, I think, still makes me... When I enter a social situation, I'm always really relieved. This is going to sound so pathetic to say in front of a whole room, but I'm always really relieved when people like me and respond well. I kind of have always had this sense of
I'm
being wary.
It.
I know, you're
I don't
doing
like
such
you at
a
all.
Good job, though. I'm so appreciative. And I don't think that kind of humility is such a bad thing, right? But I was lucky. I had parents who were really supportive. The experience I had didn't go on forever in this way that, you know, really scarred me. And so this is, I think, typical. Most people recover from episodes of bullying in their lives, and they go on to talk about it and think about it in other ways. The problem is that for some kids who don't have the kind of support I did or have just a more devastating experience, we see these long-term effects. There's recently a study out from Duke, which honestly shocked me, showing that 20 years on, people who'd been victims of bullying or who were both bullies and victims had strikingly higher rates of depression and anxiety disorders and suicidal thinking. And the researcher who did this work, who's not like a typical bullying studies guy, said, you know, he basically ran the numbers because he thought there wasn't going to be anything there. And when he saw the findings, they were so striking that now his message to his colleagues is we have to take this kind of peer abuse as seriously as we take child abuse.
Wow. Let's talk about bully side. Which you have a problem with that concept of bully side, that you can take a healthy kid, add bullying, and kill that kid, which is basically what bully side kind of means in the public imagination. You write, the seductive narrative of the bully side is dangerous. I get why it might be simplistic, and you certainly demonstrate, I think, with the stories you unpack of three different incidents of bullying that you really dig into, and you interview all the players, the victims, the parents, the administrators, the teachers, the bullies. As a piece of reporting, the book is just a remarkable, staggering achievement. but why do you think it is dangerous as opposed to simplistic or two-dimensional? Why is the narrative of bully side dangerous?
Well, I worry that in this oversimplification, we are demonizing certain kids. You know, it is
the bullies.
The bullies, yeah. There's a way in which once you are labeled a bully, and particularly if you then are blamed for another kid's death, there's all kinds of moral outrage that, and that's actually sort of the seductive part of the bully side narrative. It's not just okay. We sort of jump all over each other to be the person to condemn the bully in that situation. And that is certainly what happened to these six teenagers in South Hadley, Massachusetts, who were blamed for the death of Phoebe Prince, a 15-year-old who
committed suicide. She was the Irish immigrant who went to school, emigrated here with her mother, went to school, was bullied. And the narrative was she was bullied to death, harassed to death by these six kids, by these three girls. And you actually got in a lot of trouble. You got a lot of pushback and anger directed your way when you began to examine what really happened and report what really happened. And it wasn't the black and white, black hats, white hats narrative that we had been sold.
Right. You know, I mean, I think especially people who work with kids tend to know that these stories often are more complicated. And in this case, I mean, this was still a completely tragic story. It just wasn't the tragic story that the media and then the prosecutor told. And my problems with what was happening all had to do with kind of proportionality, right? So I wasn't saying that the kids who were accused, there were these six kids, they got lumped together as the South Hadley Six. And they faced 10-year prison sentences, and in which the charges really did blame them for Phoebe's death. So it's not that none of them did anything wrong. That would be wildly off the mark. But the notion, first of all, they were differently situated. There were some kids who were much more culpable than others. It's actually a story in which it's really one of the boys, not the girls, who turned out, I think, to have the most culpability. The problem was, first of all, is bringing criminal charges really what we should be doing when essentially what these kids did was, some of them, was to call Phoebe a slut? Not a good thing, but is that really 10 years of prison threat? And then the second problem is just this idea that rather than focusing on mental health services and suicide prevention and the underlying problems that Phoebe had that contributed to her decision to take her own life,
that
we were only blaming.
That exactly. She had issues with depression, she had anxiety about her parents' separation and potential divorce, she was on and off her meds, and the problem is that the kids who were then picking on her, and this is often my issue when people talk about bully side and it's more complicated and you just, you know, depression is this huge contributing factor, is kids in a school don't know which kid is vulnerable, and where bullying can perhaps not be bully side, not be homicide, but it can be the final straw. It can be what pushes that kid to act, to act on their suicidal ideation. So when knowing that, how do we absolve or forgive
the kids who were that contributing factor.
Yeah.
So I...
How do you have sympathy for those kids?
Well, I mean, right. I guess one answer I would give to that is that when you think about adolescence and how kids' brains are not completely developed and what it means for them to be criminally culpable, in a lot of contexts, we really take into account the fact that their brains aren't finished developing. And yet we seem to lose all sight of that in this kind of rush to judgment in these cases. I mean, again, it's not that there's no responsibility there, and you're right about this problem of the trigger, but I think we also need to keep in mind what they could have fairly anticipated from their behavior, right? I mean, we can both worry about the underlying vulnerability of the kids who are then driven to this and really try to protect them without going so far into the direction of blaming kids that we forget that, you know, they're just kids too.
But to say that to the kid who bullied Seth Walsh, who you say in the conclusion, you talk about some kids who were, their deaths were credited to the bullying, but their suicide notes, they didn't mention the bullying. Seth Walsh's suicide note is all about his bullies and all about his school. How do we say to these kids, you know, it's like playing Russian roulette when you bully randomly. You don't know which kid, when you pull that trigger and bully, is going to put a bullet into that kid's head. I don't even know if there's a question here. It feels, do we just have to accept that every once in a while, because bullying is going to happen, and because the intention isn't there to harm, and the person who is bullying doesn't know that that kid is that vulnerable, that this is just a price we're going to have to pay, that every once in a while a kid is going to, who's vulnerable, has other underlying issues, is going to be the target of bullies and die, and it isn't, and commit suicide, and it isn't then our responsibility to turn to those bullies and make an example of them and hold them accountable?
Well, I'm not a big fan of making examples of people, because I think it's a kind of selective form, right? It's like a few kids are getting strung up for the sins of many kids, and that tends to make me nervous. But no, I don't think we have to accept this. I mean, that's not, I don't think at all, the message of my work. What I do think is that you have to think about where you get the most prevention. And I think the most prevention really comes from making sure that kids who are vulnerable to suicide are getting what they need in order to do better, right? It's a different conversation. And I don't think that the blaming is really going to get us to the point where the kids who are in some ways acting like contributors are going to stop, right? That kind of deterrence has never really worked in other contexts. So I'm not sure why we think it's suddenly going to succeed in this one.
Emily Bazelon, the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She spoke with Stranger editorial director Dan Savage at Town Hall on April 29th, 2013. Savage is also the author of American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Emily Bazelon and Dan Savage in a moment. 822-949-KUOW. Jon Kabat-Zinn later this evening. He's the best-selling author of Coming to Our Senses. He reviews groundbreaking research into mindfulness as a non-pharmacological technique to counteract anxiety, depression, pain, and other conditions. That'll be tonight at 10:30. Also later this evening, we're going to hear a former locomotive engineer questioning Transport Canada regulations that allowed the company involved in last weekend's derailment, explosions, and fire in Quebec to operate with only one crew member. Also, urban farmers are abandoning their poultry, and a Minneapolis resident has set up a sanctuary to save the birds. And a forensic anthropologist who is leading a team of specialists to recover the remains of a military aircraft that crashed 60-some years ago near Anchorage, Alaska. All of those items tonight at 11. Weather outlook for the Seattle area. For tonight, lows around 50, partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Friday, highs near 70, cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly sunny. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows around 50, partly cloudy in the evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. And Saturday highs again around 70 degrees, cloudy in the morning, then becoming mostly sunny.
KUOW and Green Stage present the 13th Annual Seattle Outdoor Theater Festival, July 13th and 14th at Volunteer Park. 2 days, 8 local theater companies, and 15 different performances of outdoor theater. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In her new book, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon interviews 3 teens caught in the thick of bullying. One endured so much harassment that her mother took her out of school. Another was attacked because of his sexuality. And one teen faced criminal charges when a bullied student committed suicide. Bazelon's book is called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Bazelon explores how the landscape of bullying has changed and how some communities have succeeded in reducing it. She spoke at Town Hall on April 29th, 2013, along with the Stranger editorial director, Dan Savage.
So you dig into these stories. You take these cases of bullying and you burrow right into them. Talk about Jacob and Aaron and their story. And this is a narrative that speaks to me because Jacob is a gay kid who's being bullied at school by Aaron, and Jacob's parents are going to school and trying to intervene and trying to make changes, not getting any satisfaction. And the bullying of this kid for being gay and being openly gay in a small town in upstate New York gets worse and worse and goes on and on. Talk about those two kids and why it isn't black and white and what you've discovered when you dug into it that made it more complicated.
You know, I mean, this story, what made it more complicated? There was a lot of, honestly, like black and white in this story, in the sense that this was a town where the adults were clearly sending the message that it was okay to, you know, take Jacob's phone and step on it and even at one point push him down the stairs because he wasn't acting like a typical boy. You know, the administrators weren't saying it's okay to be homophobic. They know that that language isn't all right. But essentially, they cast the problem with Jacob not as one about how he was gay, but that he wasn't acting normal, right? There was a way in which, like, it was okay to be a gay kid who looked like a straight kid. It was not okay to be a gay kid who was wearing nail polish and had his hair dyed.
And he, like many gay kids do, as a tactic, he was aggressively gay as a form of flipping off the people who were f***ing with him. He was, the administrators that you write about, they pointed to some other gay kid who had graduated from the school
previously. He was the model, right?
Like, who was a good gay, who was respectful
exactly.
And polite.
Like straight-laced.
And straight-laced and submissive.
Right.
Right?
I think that's right.
And Jacob gets in people's faces.
Exactly.
Because they're accusing him of being gay, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to be gayer than you can handle.
That was, and I mean, God love him for it. He is like, he's such a great kid, and in reporting on this a couple years later, was really struck by how both brave and foolhardy he was, right? Brave in that he was basically like, I'm going to be myself no matter what it takes and what trouble it causes for me. But foolhardy in the sense that he was in an environment where there was like the opposite of support for this, and he really did suffer as a result. You know, the other thing about that story that I found incredibly enraging, frankly, was that the good gay kid you were just talking about, a kid whose name is Eric Barnett, he had a few years earlier tried to start a gay straight alliance at this school. And we know that this is like a really good buffer for gay kids. And not just gay kids, these are organizations that help all kids at schools. Schools are healthier places when kids have this place to discuss issues of sexuality and come together. And what happened to Eric Barnett was that when he wanted official school approval of his group, the superintendent had him come before the board. He did a whole presentation. He got most of the kids at this
80%.
The 80% of the kids signed a petition in support. The argument he made to them was like, okay, I know you don't want to be in my group, but other kids should have the choice. And they responded to that libertarian argument. And he, you know, really did his homework. He came with statistics, and the school board turned him down. And what really killed me about this story was that they stripped the school logo from his website. They wouldn't let the kids in his group have a photo in the yearbook. And these were kids who were trying to do exactly what kids should do to try and help each other. A couple years on, Eric had graduated. There's Jacob having all of these problems at school, problems that eventually led to a lawsuit. And I said to Jacob, you know, if there'd been a GSA, do you think that would have helped? He couldn't even imagine such a thing at his school. It was so inconceivable to him. And I just felt like that was an incredibly upsetting missed opportunity.
On page 185, you write, it's wrong to attribute any one suicide to bullying.
Are you asking me a true or false question?
Yes, basically.
You know, now you're trying to, like, corner me here.
No, I'm not trying to corner you.
You know, look, I what I feel about these stories is that until you have really reported one out and heard all sides of it, you don't know what happened. So I can't say to any one particular person, like the story of Seth Walsh you brought up, that I'm sitting in judgment and I know that bullying can't be. That just isn't true. And I've had that sense of humility in trying to understand what's been happening to these girls. You and I have been talking about these cases. There's a girl named Rataya Parsons in Nova Scotia who committed suicide recently, and another girl in California.
And one in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Right.
Same.
Amanda Todd, exactly. And these girls, bullying, I think, is actually a misnomer for what happened to them. They experienced something that they say was date rape that then led to absolutely humiliating sexual photos going around the internet. And in Amanda Todd's case, there was really like adult blackmailing and stalking going on. But, you know, in these cases, we're talking about a lot of trauma. And I kind of go by what the suicide prevention experts say. And when I called them to ask them about the Rataya Parsons case, this girl in Nova Scotia, whose the facts match what I was just saying, the suicide expert I was talking to said, you know, that could be a kid who was pretty healthy until that point and then just experienced so much going wrong that it really did drive her to commit suicide. So I feel really hesitant to generalize. At the same time, I think it's really important not to be thinking of bullying as the catch-all answer for teenage suicide, because it's just not going to lead us.
But knowing that bullying can light a fuse that destroys a kid's life, and you can't know which kid has that fuse or how short it is, we have to, and you don't argue in the book, we shouldn't work on bullying, we shouldn't change the culture. That's what the whole book is about. That's what it builds to at the end. Talk about some of the ways in which you found programs that worked, that weren't zero tolerance psychosis, but were programs that did build that power of character and empathy that you write about in the book.
Well, you know, the most important thing, I think, is that I wish there was some kind of magic bullet, but anyone who promises you that they will come in for the day for a few $1,000s and do one assembly or one staff training, and then you can check bullying off your list, like, that is not going to work. We just know that. You can plant the garden with one big unity day, but it's a garden, and you have to tend it every day. And, you know, I think this really does come down to changing the culture so that instead of being mean in order to advance socially, because this is rational behavior sometimes, kids will advance socially by standing up for each other, right? And there are schools that have that kind of culture where empathy is something that's built in from the very earliest age. It's woven into the fabric of the place. And families are really helping to instill and reinforce those values. And there's a community where essentially bullying is socially unacceptable. So then the question is, how do we reproduce that? And I think when you have programs that start with kids that are younger and really give them a vocabulary for talking about how to express and regulate their emotions, that's a huge part of it. And then another thing that these schools have in common is they are calm, orderly places where adults are treating each other well. When I walk into a school and I hear adults yelling at kids or sniping at each other, I know that I'm going to see more bullying there because the kids are absorbing those messages from the grown-ups.
I wanted to ask you, there's one thing I just wanted to read. You write, they have to teach early and often to address anti-LGBT bullying in schools, that there's nothing wrong with the sexuality of gay students or with the lives they will lead. To truly take this on, schools have to get young kids to think about how family structure can vary and about the ways in which children themselves police gender boundaries. Discouraging boys from playing with dolls, say, or girls from joining a football game at recess. The point isn't to push more boys to play with dolls or more girls to play football. It's to free the few who want. It's to free the few who want to from pure condemnation. I wanted to like shout that at every like liberal progressive parent I know who is shoving dolls at their boy children that they do not want to play with, and shoving footballs and trucks at their girls' children that they do not want to play with. That it isn't about undoing gender norms, because gender norms, there's kind of a hardwired aspect to it.
Right.
It's about somehow draining the pus from the stigma and the bullying and the policing of gender roles that children engage in. My own child, despite having parents, right, was doing that to other kids, was very, almost more invested in what gender roles might be or should be or could be in the world and what would be expected of him as a boy than a kid with a mother and a father might have been.
Right. Well, so when I was writing that passage, I was thinking about my 10-year-old, who is a very typical boy, and, you know, telling him to play with dolls is really not going to work that well. So when Simon, my son, was in kindergarten, he got to be friends with a boy in his class who does like to play with dolls and was not really dressing as a girl at that time, but had done that in nursery school and is actually now doing more of that. Simon and this other kid were friends and they were playing after school. But I was worried that Simon was not going to be helping this kid, right? I just didn't feel like my 5-year-old could be trusted not to judge this other kid. You know, now it's a few years later, they're a little older, and this is a school in which it's okay to be a boy who dresses like a girl. And so now I feel like, exactly as you're saying, all the sort of tension is drained from this relationship. I just think Simon takes it for granted. This is the way this boy is. He usually plays with other girls, but sometimes he's really fun to talk to. They have total Harry Potter bonding. And it's like all the just energy has been drained out of worrying about this for me. And I really thank the school and feel like just being in a place where there's more than one way to be a boy is such an important lesson for little kids growing up.
Emily Bazelon, the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She spoke with Stranger editorial director Dan Savage at Town Hall on April 29th, 2013. Savage is also the author of American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Emily Bazelon and Dan Savage in a moment. 836, 94.9 KUOW. Later this evening, we're going to hear the Vice President of Teamsters Canada Rail Conference, a labor union, tell what changes need to be made to prevent another accident like the one in Quebec this past weekend, where tanker cars loaded with crude oil were left unattended and rolled down a track by themselves, derailed, exploded, and caused a massive fire that claimed more than a dozen lives. That's coming up later this evening. Also, a resident of Aleppo describes life inside a blockaded area of the city where food and other necessities are becoming more and more difficult to find, both those items in the 11 o'clock hour tonight. Also this evening, the dispute over same-sex marriage is returning from the Supreme Court back to the states. We're going to hear a conversation about how it'll play out in legislatures, courts, and ballot initiatives. That's tonight at midnight. Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 50, partly cloudy this evening, then becoming mostly cloudy. Friday highs near 70 degrees, cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly sunny. Same kind of back and forth clouds and sun for Friday night and Saturday as well. Sub Pop Records co-founder Jonathan Poneman talks about the iconic Seattle company's 25-year history. Also a look at why the groundbreaking TV series Twin Peaks remains popular nearly 25 years after leaving the air. And listeners and KUOW staff name names. Namely, their favorite teachers, and they tell how those teachers provided inspiration. All three of those items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. The 2013 lineup includes local band Death Cab for Cutie, playing Transatlanticism, Heart, and more. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Emily Bazelon is a senior editor at Slate and the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She spoke with Dan Savage, editorial director of The Stranger, at Town Hall on April 29, 2013. Savage speaks next.
Decades ago, there were cultural panics and sex panics about the automobile because somebody could take your daughter for a drive. And there were sex panics about the telephone because somebody could communicate with other people in your house without your knowledge, or communicate with your kids without your knowledge. There is some aspect of sex panic and cultural panic about cyberbullying, about
internet.
Twitter, about the internet, about Facebook. But the actual fact on the ground is it has taken something, this propensity that kids have to be cruel, and magnified its potential impact a thousandfold in the lives of some children who are being persecuted.
Right. So the way I think about this is that our first worry about the internet was kind of stranger danger, right? The fear of predators. That is devastating, but very rare. What's much more common is this kind of run-of-the-mill, low hum of hostility that kids inflict on each other, frankly. And what I find worrisome in the social media context is that sites like Facebook, their whole business model is predicated on giving up your privacy and on widespread sharing, right? That's like the whole like model for advertisers rests on that. And they're also building brand loyalty among teenagers. It's not so much the money they're making from them right this minute. It's the idea of having them as lifelong customers. All of that militates against preventing bullying. Because one of the big things that happens on Facebook is if you have hundreds of friends and you're everything you write is open to them and their friends, you have this big network. And that can really magnify the effect of a post because it can go viral or for what kids feel like this great exposure in front of a big audience. So that's the concern I think that we really need to work on. That's not about panic, but really about kids' lived experience.
Do you have a Facebook page?
I do have a Facebook page. I kind of use it in a desultory, pathetic way to post my articles and like the occasional, and your articles or your podcast. Anyone I feel like I want to, you know, thank. I don't use it for private information. I have a colleague, our Slate tech columnist, Farhad Manju, who did an article the other day that said how to make sure all your Facebook information is private. And it just said, leave Facebook with the link to how you delete your page.
Do you let your children have Facebook pages?
So this has not arisen yet. So my poor children, right? I mean, they're 10 and 13. Their mother just wrote a book about cyberbullying. It just kind of sucks to be them, as they would tell you.
So my kid and your kid should start a support group.
They should. They'll all get together, children of parents who think
who
way too
their
much.
Lives, right.
Exactly. So my 13-year-old has not really asked yet to go on Facebook, partly because he knows, I think, that we would say no. And I'm all about delay. It's not that I think he's... I know he's going to eventually there's going to be too much social capital and he'll be missing out and he'll go on. But I feel like one of the things that high school students often say to me, actually, is that they look back on middle school and they wish that, you know, oh, they got into so much trouble. If only they'd been older, they would have been able to handle it better. So I really do feel like the longer you can put it off, the better.
But it's not just Facebook anymore. It's Facebook, it's Twitter, it's Instagram. It's Vine now.
Right, right. No, it's true. And, you know, one of the things that these sites bring up when I or other people are criticizing them for not doing more is that if you police the kids too much, they'll just go find some other more toxic environment. There is a whack-a-mole aspect of all of this. On the other hand, the sites also are only as powerful as they have mass appeal, right? So Facebook has, last count from last year, 20 million teenagers, as well as 7.5 million under 13-year-olds, even though they're not legally supposed to be there. That makes it the elephant in the room, and I think that they, as a result, should have more responsibility.
And you got onto Facebook. You went in, you observed them doing their policing dance, which seemed a bit of a performance for you, and you actually caught them in a moment where a page that, by their own standards, should have been pulled down, that had been reported to them repeatedly, had an order on it to ignore all further reports of bullying or complaints about this page.
Right. So, yes, I brought to them a page called, I love this, Let's Start Drama, which was starting a lot of drama at a middle school. I was reporting in, and the adults had, you know, properly clicked all the right buttons. It was 6 months later, page still up. And you're right, they had just made a mistake. It wasn't surprising. They also told me they
were
optimizing.
Two people made the exact same mistake.
Yes, two people.
It didn't look like a mistake.
Right, right. Well, this was a team of, called the hate and harassment team. The
That's what we call the staff at the Stranger team.
the people on this team were optimizing for half a second as the amount of time they would spend on each complaint. Of course they were going to be missing some of this, right? You know, Facebook has chosen to have bullying and harassment be against its own rules. Twitter actually doesn't have a rule like that. But so then the question is, okay, what does it actually mean to have that rule? And I think that enforcement challenge is one that Facebook is not really interested in completely taking up, because it would either require hiring a warehouse of people or coming up with some kind of algorithm, which I actually think is... You know, these are smart people. I think that it is possible, and I've been talking to a guy at MIT who's been working on this. You know, not that we want to be censoring a ton of speech, but the idea that there could be some filter that sees a post that looks like it's cruel and just says to the kid or maybe the adult, are you sure you want to send this to 400 people? That seems like the kind of step that these sites could take without going too far and over-policing.
Such an insane experiment we're conducting on our kids right now at this moment. I think back to when I was my son's age, when I was 15 years old, and the things that I did that I am so grateful there is no documentation for, the things that I did that I am so grateful I didn't do in front of everyone, that if I had shared it with a few trusted friends on Facebook or on Twitter, that the chance of this could have been shared then with the entire school, and on those rare occasions, as happens, people all over the country, people all over the world, potentially. Our kids, they are not going to be able to run away from who they were as adolescents or forget it or stuff it down the memory hole because of this fetish for documenting every experience, every feeling, every post. This isn't a question. This is just I'm in a
hand-wringing session.
A hand-wringing session now, right.
Right. No, I mean, I think this is, you're right. It's an experiment. It's something we feel mystified by because all parents today, at least I think, did not have this in their own growing up. And so we don't know how it ends, right? I mean, you were saying earlier that you feel like teenagers have to perform their lives for so much of what they're doing. They can't just have an experience. They also have to figure out how to write it up and how to position themselves. It seems very exhausting to me. And yet it's clearly the way in which their lives are moving. And so we have to I think what is important here is we can't just like welcome them into this new world and then have them figure it all out by themselves. We need to, in our fumbling way, try to help guide them through it.
You write, in discussing cyberbullying, home was the one place where you knew you would be safe. There's one thing that I actually think you don't address in the book, which is the parent as bully,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge issue for LGBT kids.
You're right.
Because home, for a lot of LGBT kids, is where they're less safe. School, paradoxically, even a school where you are being bullied, for a lot of LGBT kids who have worse bullies in the home, who have bullying parents, school is the refuge. I've often sort of gotten in the faces of people who say that this is new, this idea that the bullies can follow you into the home, that home is no longer this refuge. That is new for straight kids.
But not for gay kids.
Not for LGBT kids who have homophobic parents.
Well, some of the research about this that I found the most interesting is that it is true that LGBT kids are at greater risk of bullying and that the bullying can reflect this larger hostile environment. And also, actually, that for them, the link to suicide is also often clearer because all of this, there's this whole toxic brew, right? It's not like it's just the bullying or it's just the larger hostility. It's all mixed together. Parents can be an incredibly important buffer in this, right? I mean, they can counteract that. But if they're not there, that is obviously an enormous problem. And then the other part of this is that even if kids' lives in school are going okay, if they're not getting acceptance from their family, they are also at much higher risk for a whole host of ills. Suicidal thinking and depression is part of it, but there's also, you know, greater risk of HIV exposure.
Drug and alcohol abuse.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think you're absolutely right, obviously, to focus on this as well. It's a problem that, as a parent, I would like to think that we are getting closer to solving, but you're shaking your head and you know more about this than I do.
As somebody who gets buried in emails every day from teenagers and from a lot of LGBT kids, we want to think the parents are all like Jacob's parents.
Right.
And have their kids' backs, or like Constance McMillan's parents, even in the tiny little town of Mississippi where she was growing up, who had her back, which kind of blew everyone's mind. But I think We really wish those parents weren't the exception, but
they may still be.
I think they are.
Right.
In
and
a
we,
lot of
you
places.
Know, look, we're in the middle of a cultural shift,
right.
And it's on the upside. It's amazing how fast the poles are moving in this direction, but we're not there yet.
We're
and
not
these
there
kids
yet.
Are on the front lines, right? I mean, to me, one real difficulty for kids like Jacob. You know, Jacob was a kid, he loved the pop star Pink, and he watched a ton of Glee. And in those contexts, he's getting this great message of acceptance, right? But that
and let your freak flag fly.
Let my freak flag fly, exactly. And God bless him for it. But in his town, that just wasn't an okay way to be. And if he hadn't had parents who had his back, I think, you know, he really could have been in trouble, and a lot of kids don't.
Dorothy Esplanade. Am I mispronouncing her name?
Esplanade.
She's a researcher professor at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, has done a lot of research into bullying. I think that there's, you know, sexuality has a huge component, not just to the bullying of LGBT kids, but to the bullying of females and slut-shaming.
The slut-shaming, right.
Misogyny and homophobia are siblings. And queer kids are policed in a way, and
so are girls,
and so
sexually
are girls.
Active girls, or perceived as sexually active,
and
girls.
Then punished for being perceived to be sexually active. And sexuality, however, as you write in the book when you talk about the problem with addressing sexuality, is this taboo, and administrators are afraid of it, and principals are afraid of it, and you have this wing of American parent land. the creationists and the sex phobes and the nuts and the religious conservatives who don't want sexuality addressed at all.
Right, and then you can't talk about it, right? Then kids
suffer
don't have any
die.
Space.
Right.
Right. There's no honest conversation going on. I mean, I've been thinking about this so much in the context of these cases of girls' photos circulating. I mean, you can call this sexting. I wish I had a kind of weightier word for it, but essentially this humiliation by...
Rape texting. I don't know what to...
It's a really weird phenomenon. It's like we haven't quite... Canada is now talking about...
We don't have a term for the that it captures what a violation it is.
How serious and virulent it is. I think that's right. So, I mean, I think you're right that these are issues that we have to... There has to be a space in which we say to teenagers, like, if you're going out drinking, you need to have someone who's got your back, who's watching for you, some kind of buddy system so that... Or, you know, if you see something that seems off to you, just ask someone else, just maybe verbalizing, do you think that's not okay? We'll make it something that you have to do something about and that you can't just walk away from. All of those kinds of questions, I just don't see a lot of honest conversations going on in a kind of organized context for kids.
And I think the ultimate irony in having those kind of conversations with kids is it's not just about protecting the bullied kids. And as you demonstrate in the book, sometimes the bullied kid bullies and sometimes the victim of bullying bullies. And it's more amorphous
complicated.
And complicated than that. But you write that bullying is linked with depression, suicide, substance abuse among both victims and bullies. So an unchecked culture of bullying doesn't just destroy the lives potentially of the victims of bullying, but of the bullies themselves.
Right. I mean, there is a way in which this is a means for identifying the kids who are in trouble, right? And one of the things I think is useful about bullying as kind of a social construct is that it cuts across class and race and all these other dividers, right? This is an issue that middle-class parents are also concerned about. So we can't just say, like, oh, that's the poor kids, or, oh, that's the kids who are messed up for that reason who have this issue. And we can't just install metal detectors in schools in poor neighborhoods and think that we're done. It's really an opportunity to think about the culture kids are growing up in this overall, overarching way and, you know, trying to make it better for all of them.
And you show that it can be made better. You show these interventions, these school-wide interventions, that don't require the charismatic principal that not every school can have, but these steps that schools and communities can take, not to bully-proof. You know, sometimes people have this idea that if bullying is addressed, your child will never come home with a hurt feeling ever again.
Right.
And we
right.
can't interpret the child coming home with a hurt feeling as evidence that there's a culture of bullying running unchecked in a school environment. Her feelings are part of life at any stage, but you really walk us through these programs that are working and real solutions that are out there and exist.
Right, and there are a lot of, I hope, resources in my book for parents and for schools. You know, one of the things I was really struck by is that if schools are willing to crunch their own data, if they're willing to ask kids, you know, how connected do you feel in this place? Are there adults you feel like you can go to if you're in trouble? How much of a sense of belonging do you have? Is bullying a problem here? Have you seen it? Have teachers turned a blind eye to it? If they're willing to find out what the answers to those numbers are, that's like a great place for them to start. It's a matter of diagnosis, right? Maybe bullying isn't the biggest problem, but they'll figure out where their weak spots are. You have to be willing, though, to find out what the numbers show.
The assumption, though, is kind of predicated on quality adults, and not every school is run by quality. Just like the assumption that home is a refuge, that means you have to have decent, loving parents who are engaged, which not every gay kid, not every straight kid has at home. But we assume that kids, that's an advantage that we would like them to have, and we assume that they should have or do have or default to the assumption that they must. And the assumption then is that schools aren't run by toxic m****ers either. Whereas we know that there are schools that are broken and toxic, that are in the hands of incompetent, callous people who don't care enough to take the steps that you outline, there are times when people have really no choice but to yank their kids.
That's true. I do think, though, that most of the time, most educators go into this work with some sense of caring about the welfares of kids. It's true. I mean, some of the kids in my book had to leave their schools, and they were, you know, and their parent, it wasn't that their parents weren't trying to help. I mean, both Jacob, who we talked about, and Monique, who's another of my main characters, she really did have to leave her school. I mean, I became utterly convinced of that watching her over the course of a year. But I don't think that is the norm. I do think that, you know, running a school, we're asking a tremendous amount of schools right now, more and more. They're supposed to be raising kids' test scores at the same time as they become places where they're helping raise our kids with us and teaching them empathy and all these social skills, and we're making them responsible for school climate in a way that I think good schools are ready to embrace because they can see the benefits for kids, both socially and academically. So I would rather give more of them the benefit of the doubt and try to think through, okay, if we're asking this of them, what tools do they need to do this right? But it's not that I obviously don't see the problems you're identifying. I just don't think it can be the driver for how we deal with them as a group.
Quickly talk about Monique for a second. You kind of crossed a line with Monique.
Yes.
And you got involved.
Yeah, I did.
You helped find a solution for this kid that,
yes,
with your social advantages, you were able to run to ground for her.
Right, you pulled strings for her. You know, so I watched Monique left school in the middle of seventh grade. A bullying situation had really escalated. Her mother had tried hard to get help, had actually spoken out at school board meetings. That completely backfired. This was a really defensive school district, and they essentially stonewalled.
And it became a PR disaster for them without end because the mother was so fierce and...
Right, but instead of, you know, settling with her, essentially, they said, you know, you can either send your daughter back to this public middle school or nothing, or you can take her home. And so Monique spent a whole year at home. And as her mother said, they were not homeschoolers. They really didn't know what to do with her. And I could see her kind of becoming more depressed and withdrawn. So she left school in January. I met her, I think, in February or March, and I was going to visit her, talking to her parents, reporting a lot at the school all that spring and summer. I just figured, of course they're going to figure out how to get her into eighth grade in September. I mean, this just couldn't... But in fact, she had nowhere to go back to school in September. And, you know, it was just making me incredibly uncomfortable. And then, weirdly, or not, because I live in Connecticut, which is a small state, someone I knew became the commissioner of education in Connecticut. And so... You know, for me,
so you
honestly,
went right to the top.
Yeah, well, it was so weird that that was even possible. But honestly, it wasn't that hard a call. I just like asked Stefan to go have a drink and told him this story. And I, you know, I do write about this. I felt like essentially there is nothing fair about who you know in the world. And to me, this was also such a class issue. If Monique's mother had had more money, she would have put her kid in private school, right? That's what parents with resources do when they don't like a school. They go somewhere else. For this family, that wasn't an option. That just didn't seem fair to me. And so, you know, to say to Stefan, someone I knew from law school, like, do you think you could take another look at this? Is there really nowhere else in the state this kid can go to school? That seemed like kind of an obvious thing.
But as a journalist and a reporter, you didn't feel any conflict about that? You didn't get any grief from your colleagues about that?
You know, I people ask me about it, as you have, and I understand that it's an issue. It just seemed like a matter of fairness. And, you know, I did think it through with my editor before I did it. And frankly, I worried that I had waited too long in my own self-interest to watch this story play out. So that was more the struggle I had for myself, was to think, like, why didn't I try to do something sooner?
Emily Bazelon, the author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She spoke with Stranger editorial director Dan Savage at Town Hall on April 29th, 2013. Savage is also the author of American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Nine o'clock, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Today's KUOW Day sponsors.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.